Well, it's a real joy and privilege for me to be able to stand here and share with you this morning. I'm very grateful that there is anyone here, given the fact of the weather we've had this week, and actually this may be the only sun we'll see. Thank you for being here. I think if my memory serves me correctly, the first time I came to Keswick was 25 years ago. I was a young university student, and my very gifted UCCF worker, a lady by the name of Elaine Duncan, brought a whole group of us here from my university. And having been raised in the Middle East and come to Christ there, it was the largest group of Christians I'd ever seen in one place was about 80 or 90. And I'll never forget the time where I came in to this tent, and was just completely overwhelmed by the fact that there were so many Christians meeting so freely in one space all at the same time. It was something I just simply was almost unimaginable to me up until that point. And it's been a delight to be able to come back from time to time. The last time I think I was here, I'm invited to give a Keswick lecture. It was my 10th wedding anniversary, and now they've invited me back. It's now my 21st wedding anniversary. And so I'd like to thank Keswick for all of those wonderful wet memories that my wife and I have shared up here together. One of the great issues we have when we talk about Christianity, or when we use that word, is there's a confusion about what that might entail, about what that means. And that's, of course, true. That's true for all language. I was about a year ago, just over a year ago, I was in the boardroom of one of the most sort of well-known banking groups in the City of London. And I was there with a couple of my colleagues, and I was there meeting with the one of the directors of that bank and also the CEO of a very large corporation in the UK. And as we were talking, one of them said to me, "Michael, let me just tell you this story because I know your sense of humor, you'll appreciate it." A couple of months ago, this guy's best friend had taken his son to be interviewed by a very well-known, at a very well-known public school in this country. And the way the interview works is the boys are invited into the headmaster's study. The headmaster sits on one side of the desk, the boy sits on the other side of the desk, and the father will sit behind the boy. So the father is in the room, but he can't see his son's face, nor can he give him any direction or suggestion about how to answer the questions. And the interview seems to be going fairly well. And then the headmaster asked this young 11-year-old quite a surprising question. He said, "Out of everything in this world and in life, what is it that terrifies you the most?" Now, isn't that an interesting question? And the boy paused for a moment and then said, "Oblivion." Now, that's quite a startling answer. Oblivion, like most words, has shades of meaning. It can mean to cease to exist in someone's mind. That's what most politicians live in fear of. It can mean to cease to exist at all, or to continue to exist in a state of existlessness. But whatever it is, it's not good. And the headmaster was clearly struck by this answer, and the boy was admitted into the school. Now, as the father is now driving his son back home, rather than celebrating the fact that his son got into the school that he was hoping to get into, he's sitting, driving the car, and the only thing he's thinking in his mind is, "My son lives in terror of oblivion." And eventually, you know, he's just praying, he's waiting for that moment, an appropriate moment, to ask the question he is desperate to ask. And eventually the conversation sort of moves in the right way, and so the father, as calmly as he can, says, in the interview, when the headmaster asked you what terrifies you the most, You said oblivion. Why did you say that exactly?" And the son looked at his father with a slightly puzzled expression and said, "Well, that was the name of that really scary ride at the fun fair we went to last week." Now, you see what was happening there. The headmaster detected a profundity in that boy's answer that really, strictly speaking, wasn't there at all. And this is one of the challenges we have whenever we come sometimes to ask and maybe raise particularly profound or difficult questions. It's not always clear necessarily what we're talking about unless things have been defined, unless we understand the parameters within which we're operating. And we now live in a world where to be a Christian or to understand the idea of Christianity has taken on various meanings. It's associated and identified with various things which, for many, in many cases, would simply not be true or even, indeed, be biblical. Now, at the same time, we see huge shifts in our culture. I was had the huge privilege a little while ago of being present to see the memorial stone for C.S. Lewis laid in Westminster Abbey. And they had a whole day of events going on before that. And then at the actual laying of the stone, there was they had a special service to commemorate his life. And then they had this big round stone. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to the Abbey to see the memorial stones laid in Poets' Corner, but you'll notice most of them wear away. And so, and they get quite beveled and worn, and sometimes the letters fade. So what the Abbey had done is it ordered a very, very hard stone, particularly hard stone, so that the engraving would not wear away over time as people walked over it. Now, this particular stone was so hard that the engraver, therefore, had trouble cutting into it to make the inscription. So I'll never forget the Dean of the Abbey explaining to me in detail. He says, but when you come to see the stone first, whatever you do, don't bend down and touch the lettering, because most of it is just chalk shaded in 3D, to make it look like it's been carved, but actually it hasn't. And so if you smudge it, it's going to ruin the effect. And we were there for that, and it was an incredible time. And afterwards, I was asked to go out for lunch with a retired army general, and we're sitting enjoying lunch in his club. And as we're talking, he's asking me lots of difficult questions. And after about a couple of hours, I say, is it my turn now? I'd like to ask you a question. And he said, that's fine. I said, I'm very interested in what I see happening in culture. I said, when I was 15 years old, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. I knew what I wanted to be, and I knew where I was going. I said, now, after I became a Christian, I said, a lot of that changed. But at 15, I was committed to a purpose and to a cause, and I was pursuing it as hard as I could. I said, now forget about being 25. I now meet people who are 35, and they're still not sure why they're here. They're just drifting through life, trying various things, and they're not committed to anything. He said, yes. I said, well, here's my question, and I'm asking you as a military leader, how do you breed leadership in the absence of commitment? And there was a pause, and he looked at me, and he says, well, Michael, you may not know this about me, but for the last few years of my operational life, I was in charge of officer selection and training for the armed services. And this was our number one problem. How do you breed leadership in the absence of commitment? He said, we have very able people come, they're willing to give it a go, they'll try it for a few years, but he says, we've never been able to crack that problem. As a matter of fact, it's still a question we're still asking ourselves. I thought, isn't that interesting? A little while later, a couple of hours later, I was in London, I was waiting for my wife and family to come and join me. We were spending the weekend down in London that weekend because I was speaking in a church there that Sunday. And I was in a store, I was buying a few provisions, we were like in a small rented apartment that weekend, so buying a few things to eat and things like that, and I heard this accent behind me, which I recognized to be a North American accent, and I turned around and said hello to this guy and got chatting to him, and I said, what are you doing here? He said, oh, well, I'm here with my wife, and she's watching a play right now, I'm not really into plays, so I'm just waiting for her to finish. And I said, you're not from around here. He said, no, I'm from America. I said, well, what do you do? He said, well, I'm retired now, but I used to run the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department. So I looked at him and said, I know exactly what you do. I've seen the movies. And yeah, so he smiled as well, and we got talking, and we talked for an hour. And about halfway through this conversation, I said to him, I said, do you mind if I ask you a question? I said, I was just having lunch with this general, and I asked him a question about how you can breed leadership in the absence of commitment. And I gave him the same narrative that I'd given the general. And the guy looked at me and he says, well, he said, for the last 5 years of my life, I was in charge of officer training for the LAPD. He said, we spent millions of dollars trying to solve this problem, flying in experts, cultural analysts, all kinds of people, trying to find a way for us to motivate people. He says, we now have officers who are running units and they don't command the respect of their rank and file because they're simply not committed. It's just simply a job. They're in it for as long as it's good for them, and then they're going to move on to something else, and we just don't know what to do about it. We live in a culture where things are shifting and moving very fast. And at the same time, we're looking for a culture that is longing to be committed to someone or something, so long as they know what it stands for. Now, I've voted in every election I'm allowed to vote in the United Kingdom. But I have to admit, at the last general election, I was struggling. Now, I knew what some parties stood for. I knew what the SNP stood for, except I just don't live in Scotland. I knew what Nigel Farage and UKIP stood for, but that's not exactly where my politics are going to take me. But I'm looking at the mainstream parties and I'm asking the question, what do you stand for? What do you represent? Can I vote for you? Can I stand with you? And it was a difficult question. harder it felt than almost any other time. Where is the kind of leadership that we're looking for, that people want to give themselves to? How do we actually breed commitment in a culture if no one really seems to stand for anything? How do we go about living in a world where people seem more interested in their convenience and in what is simply easiest for them, rather than for actually making a stand and being willing to pay a price or make any form of sacrifice in order to see something go forward? So what I'm speaking to you about this morning is not just something that's peculiar to the church or to people interested in the Christian faith. I see this as a global issue which is affecting the Western developed world in particular. What does it mean to be committed? How do we understand this culture of convenience? And how on earth are we going to engage in it? Because if any group of people have anything to say about this, it should be the church. It should be Christians. It should be looking at the gospel of Christ and the person of Christ, that we should have and understand something about the nature of what it means to give yourself completely. And yet the simple truth is that for many of us, as we sit in this room, what we're praying for is that we will never hear a sermon that explains that tithing is meant to be more than 10%, because that's about as much of our time as our attention that we can give. And we find ourselves at times drifting, wondering why things aren't more different than they really are. We live in a time and in a moment where we're struggling both to understand definition, to understand the nature of commitment, and where we seem to be driven perpetually by convenience. Now, what I would like to try and do is frame my remarks to you this morning using initially an outline developed by a guy called Professor John Gray. Now, there are two John Grays out there. One wrote a very famous book called Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. That is not him. Okay, I am talking about a different John Gray. Now, the John Gray I'm particularly interested in was a professor of the history of European political thought at the LSE, and has written many, many popular books. And one of them is entitled Straw Dogs. And if you've never read Straw Dogs by Professor John Gray, I'd urge you, buy a copy and read it. It's not particularly long. But I think out of all of the books I've read by atheists in the last 10 to 15 years, it's amongst one of the most penetrating and honest. And what John Gray does in a few short pages, it's not a particularly long book, is he begins to outline some of the issues that he sees that our society must now face. And this guy is well known. He occupied the political chair at one of the world's most famous universities when it comes to political and economic thought. And the books he has now written in this area, like Straw Dogs, have sold millions of copies and been translated into dozens and dozens and dozens of languages. So I'm settling on him, not because all atheists would agree with him, that simply wouldn't be true, some would definitely disagree with him, but because he is very, very popular, because he has a large voice, because he has a large influence, and also because he brings rigor to what he wants to say. Now, what John Gray does in his book, Straw Dogs, is he outlines why, as an atheist, he is opposed to humanism. He describes himself as an atheist who hates humanism. Now, the reason why he hates humanism, he says, is that humanism has not given up Christianity's cardinal error. And what is the cardinal error of the Christian faith, he argues? Well, he says, it is that there is something special about being human. That is the most basic flaw in the Christian faith, that Christians think that they're better animals than any other animal out there. But actually, Gray argues, we're all animals and we're all the same. But because humanism has not given up this cardinal error of the Christian faith, because humanists believe there is something special about human life, something precious about human life, he says humanists are doomed to repeat their mistakes. As a matter of fact, his argument is that humanism is simply Christianity re-expressed in secular words. Now, I'm going to give you various quotes coming out of what he says, because I'd like him to speak for himself. I think he does it very well. Please forgive me while I quote him so extensively. But this is what he says. He says, the humanists have a belief in progress, which is a secular version of the Christian faith. In the world shown to us by Darwin, however, there is nothing to be called progress. The idea of humanity taking charge of destiny makes sense only if we ascribe consciousness and purpose to the human species. But Darwin's discovery was that species are currents in the drift of genes. The idea that humanity can shape its future assumes it is exempt from this truth. Now, he then goes through and says, look, once we understand this, then a whole series of things happen. He says, number one, we must give up on the idea of meaning. There is no meaning. If we truly leave Christianity behind, he says, we must give up the idea that human history has a meaning. Neither in the ancient pagan world nor in any other culture has human history ever been thought to have an overarching significance. So let's give up this idea of meaning. I find it incredible, as my colleague Ravi Zacharias says, these philosophers who write books on meaninglessness, huge thick tomes, all the time assuming they have something meaningful to say. But he says, first of all, therefore, let's get rid of this idea of meaning. Secondly, he says, we must get away from the idea of persons, that human beings are somehow special, that they have personhood. He says, look, that idea underlies all human rights, and it is false. It is wrong. He says this, among Christians, the cult of personhood may be forgiven. For them, everything of value in the world emanates from a divine person, in whose image human beings are made. But once we have relinquished Christianity, the very idea of being a person becomes suspect, and we have to get rid of it. Thirdly, Gray says, we are not there is no meaning, we are not persons, and we can't therefore be talked about being held responsible for our actions. Here's what he says, we cannot choose to be what we are born. In that case, we cannot be responsible for what we do. The upshot of neuroscientific research is that we cannot be the authors of our own actions. So human beings are not responsible for anything they do. Now, can you understand why for some people this would be liberating? Every time we do something wrong, well, that's just the way we are. I can't help myself. I couldn't stop myself. I felt powerless in the face of. I have this desire, I have this instinct, I act on it. I had the huge privilege of listening to John Gray in the House of Lords. There was a debate on just after the financial crisis. You may remember that. We had this big banking crisis in which the banking community, having been taught at university that all ethics is relative, treated ethics as relative, and then everyone got angry with them. And I remember being there at this panel, hosted actually by the BBC, and we were there in the House of Lords, in a meeting room in the House of Lords. A member of the Lords said, Michael, I think you might be interested to come along to this. And because John Gray was one of the contributors, I thought, wow, I would love to be here to hear what he has to say about the banking crisis. And his take on it was this. Bankers are a group of immoral people who've acted totally irresponsibly, and they need to take the consequence of their actions, and they should pay the price for the mistakes they've made. And I'm sitting there thinking, I was so tempted to sort of interrupt and say, I have a copy of your book I was hoping you would sign. And but this narrative that we're not responsible for our actions is becoming the dominant one in our culture. In the city in where I live, in Oxford, I can remember a year ago speaking to a large group of students, several hundred of them, and a group of them coming up to the end and saying, it is not true we are responsible for what we do. It is simply not true. I said, are you being taught that? They said, yes. I said, what disciplines are you in? Sociology, anthropology, psychology, psychiatry. All of them are being taught that we do what our genes tell us to do. We are not responsible, ultimately, for our actions. This is going to become one of the biggest debates of the Western world for the next two decades. What does it mean to be human? And can we be held responsible for anything that we do or say? Lastly, then, having given up all of these ideas, he then also then says, look, you must understand that there is also, therefore, no such thing as truth. He says this, modern humanism is the faith that through science, humankind can know the truth, and so be set free. But if Darwin's theory of natural selection is true, this is impossible. The human mind serves evolutionary success, not truth. To think otherwise is to resurrect the pre-Darwinian era that humans are different from other animals. Darwinian theory tells us, he says, that an interest in truth is not needed for survival or reproduction. More often, it is a disadvantage. Deception is common amongst primates and birds. Truth has no advantage, no specific evolutionary advantage over error. Quite to the contrary, evolution will select for self-deception, rendering some facts and motives unconscious so as not to betray by the subtle signs of self-knowledge the deception being practiced. In the struggle for life, a taste for truth is a luxury, or else it is a disability. Now, when you give up truth, when you give up meaning, when you give up the idea of persons, and you also give up the idea of purpose as a result, then you have to sit and you say you cannot be responsible for your actions. The last thing that must fall, therefore, is morality. There is no such thing as morality. He labels morality as an ugly superstition. And in order to illustrate his point, he tells a true story. Now, the story is of a Nazi concentration camp where a guard, Nazi guard, raped one of the Jewish male soldiers. Now, the Nazi guard didn't want to be accused or caught, so he stole his victim's cap, knowing that if he stole the cap, if you appeared in the parade in the morning without wearing your cap, you would simply be shot, no questions asked. Now, the guy who was raped that night, he stole another inmate's cap. So that morning, he was able to wear a cap, and the other prisoner, who woke up in the morning finding his cap mysteriously disappeared, was shot. Now, Rob Frister, then wrote a book in which he tells his own story, and that's what John Gray relates here. Here's how it comes up in this former concentration camp victim's own words. Roman Frister says, "The officer and the capo walked the lines. I counted the seconds as they counted the prisoners. I wanted it to be over. They were up to row 4. The capless man didn't beg for his life. We all knew the rules of the game, the killers and the killed alike. There was no need for words. The shot rang out without warning. There was a short, dry, echoless thud. One bullet to the brain. They always shot you in the back of the skull. There was a war on. Ammunition had to be used sparingly. I didn't want to know who the man was. I was simply delighted to be alive." And after this gentleman finishes his story, John Gray then picks up the narrative, and he says this. "Well, what does morality say the young prisoner ought to have done? It says human life has no price. Very well. Should he therefore have consented to lose his life? Or does the pricelessness of life mean that he was justified in doing anything to save his own? Morality is supposed to be universal and categorical. But the lesson of Roman Frister is that morality is a convenience to be relied upon only in normal times." Now, I remember, as I came to this point in Gray's analysis, putting the book down and taking a very deep breath, and it occurred to me, if it could be said of the church that we only stand up for what is morally right when it is convenient to us, there is a problem. As a matter of fact, part of Gray's analysis would be, look, people are Christians because it is convenient for them. It brings them some degree of comfort. It makes them feel good about themselves. It makes them feel better about life and gives them hope in something to come. And also, for some people, it's good for their children. They pack their kids off to the Sunday school and they're told to behave better, and that makes your life as a parent easier. And so since it's both convenient and it's comforting and it makes life easier, that's why we have it. But, he says, when the chips are down, when it could cost you everything, what then? And Gray would say, Christians, along with everyone else, will abandon all sense of moral conviction and commitment, and they will do with whatever is convenient. And I remember just thinking that through, thinking, wow, this is so far removed from what I understand Christianity to be about, it's almost laughable. It is not a matter of convenience. That is simply not what it is about. Now, it's true that at times we have reduced the Christian gospel into something which is much less glorious and wonderful than it is. But at those times, that's why we need to come back to what Jesus Christ actually said and what he actually taught in order to help remind us. So let's just take for a moment one of the convenient stories that Jesus tells that are good for children to make them make our life more convenient. Let's take the story of the Good Samaritan. Now, I'm sure you all know the story of the Good Samaritan. Many of you may well have been at school where you were given and told the story of the Good Samaritan, or maybe saw it acted out, because it helps us and teaches us to be nice to other people. Isn't that the point of the story? Well, let's just look at that story a little more carefully, just to understand something of the nature of what Christ is talking about here. If you remember the setting of the story, an expert in the law comes to Jesus and he says, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And many people have obviously commented, you don't normally do anything to inherit anything. You normally are someone to inherit something. It's normally your children that inherit, and we are normally suspicious of people who try to do things to get someone else's inheritance. As a matter of fact, well, let's even go into modern law. Now, Jesus asks him a question, and the guy replies, what is written in the law, Jesus says. And the guy says, well, you have to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, just think about that for a moment. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. Anyone who feels that they have obeyed this command in the last week, please feel free to stand now. And, now, it may be possible that we could fool ourselves at times and think, you know what, God, I do love you 100%. Everything I have is yours. I'm living for you 100% every day in every aspect of my life, my thought life, my emotional life, what drives me, my motives, my actions. It's all perfect before you. And then Jesus adds, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, there's something very interesting in that. I had a colleague who was out in Asia, and he asked an audience maybe a bit smaller than this, to close their eyes and imagine peace. What does peace look like? I wonder what picture comes to your mind. After about 15 or 20 seconds, he invited the audience to share their pictures. One person talked about a field filled with flowers and beautiful trees. Another one of snow-capped mountains and this incredible alpine landscape. Another one of a beautiful, still lake. My wife and I made the mistake of ignoring the BBC weather forecast yesterday and going out into the lake. We got halfway out, and then it started to rain. The rain came down, and the boat went down, and we started to head towards shore. But everybody imagined these pictures, the still lakes, the fields. There was one thing common in every single picture. Do you know what it was? There were no people in them. Isn't that interesting? When asked to imagine peace, the first thing we do is eliminate everyone else. Now, by the time Jesus Christ has finished putting out the requirement, the response here should be, but that's impossible. Have you met my neighbor? No one can fulfill this. That's the point. This is unfulfillable. And the guy, having listened to all of this, goes, who is my neighbor? Now, isn't that interesting? He still thinks that it's possible to live a perfect life before God, but he is still bothered by his neighbor. Now, the Old Testament gives a definition. It tells you that a neighbor is the son of your brother's house or someone from the land. So the question is, well, how far does that extend? And maybe if it's small enough and it's just the people you really like, you might just about be okay. That's what he seems to be thinking. He wants to justify himself. So Jesus then tells this very simple, innocuous-looking story. And you all know the story very well. Okay? There is this man, and he's traveling down this road from Jerusalem to Jericho. And he is attacked by robbers. They strip him of his clothes, beat him, and go away, leaving him half dead. Now, people come by. Now, we're not going to go into the detail this passage deserves, but let me just say a few things. The setting of this parable is very, very, very important. Look, if I were to tell you that that last night in Keswick, a man fell amongst robbers, was stripped naked, left unconscious by the side of the road, and the chair of the Keswick trustees went by, the CEO of Keswick Ministries went by, and then someone else, you know, townsfolk came by, you would sit there rightly thinking, well, why didn't those other two do something about it? Aren't they meant to be the people who should be doing it? And that's how we interpret this parable. That's to miss the point. Let's suppose now to tell you the story that you're driving through Helmand province in an armored car. You see a half-dead body by the side of the road in that part of Iraq. And you think about it and you decide not to stop and you continue on your journey. Now would you blame the person for not stopping? And now it's a bit more different, isn't it? That is a very dangerous part of the world. It is completely lawless. People are being shot and killed all the time. As a matter of fact, roadside bombs and roadside ambushes are common. This is a trap very often to get people out of their armored cars so then they can be picked off by snipers or small devices, bombs. It changes it, doesn't it? Walking by and ignoring them in Keswick, not so acceptable. In a very dangerous part of the world, well, easier. Well, the road from Jerusalem to Jericho ran straight through the middle of nowhere. It was filled with bandits and robbers. It was a very, very dangerous place. So when Jesus told this story, everyone's thinking, oh my goodness, would I stop? That's a very dangerous place to stop. So when the priest passes by on the other side of the road, most of the audience are not condemning him. It is dangerous. That is difficult. And when the Levite goes behind him and also passes by on the other side, that's also not such a big deal either. Everyone knows how dangerous this is. And now a Samaritan comes. Now the Samaritans, as you know, hated by the Jews. There's no love between them. The Samaritan, we read, gets off his donkey, and he treats the person. Now there's a big unanswered question in this story, and the question is this: is he a son of the land? Is the guy beaten up and left half dead by the side of the road, is he Jewish or not? Now you see, the priest is walking from Jerusalem to Jericho. That means he's finished his priestly duties, he's fulfilled them. Now it's true, if he touches a dead body, he becomes defiled. But he can get repurified back down in Jericho, and he's finished his stint. If he's walking from Jerusalem to Jericho, he's not going to serve as a priest up in the big temple for a long time. So he has more than enough time to go through the ceremonial washing, but it's a very complicated process, and it takes several weeks, and you know, it's just a lot of hassle. So as he comes by, he sees the dead guy, or this unconscious guy by the side of the road, and if he is Jewish, he should help. That's what he should do, if he is Jewish. But here's the problem. He has no clothes, and he's unconscious. Now, why is this important? Well, the fact he cannot speak means that the priest can't ask him a question. Now, there are 9 sort of Jewish dialects, accents, if you like, that would be readily discernible to anyone from the area. A bit like in England, we could talk about, you can spot someone from Liverpool or Manchester or Edinburgh or London, you just speak to them. But he can't speak to him because the guy's unconscious. We make value judgments about people all the time, how intelligent they are, how well-educated they are, from their accent. You've been doing that with me ever since I stood up in front of this stage. And the priest has no access to that. He can't ask any questions because the guy's unconscious. And he must also be lying face down. Now, why do I say that? Well, he's been stripped naked. If you strip a Jewish man naked and he's lying face up, you can tell he is Jewish. Now, if you're not sure how that works, do come back later this evening, speak with either Jonathan Lamb or someone like that who's well-educated, and they'll explain to you how you can tell. So if this guy has indeed been stripped naked, he's obviously lying face down because there's no way of telling. So it's difficult, isn't it? He may or may not be Jewish. He may or may not be dead, and it may or may not be an ambush. Now, maybe if we had some definition, some certainty about any of these things, maybe the priest should risk his life. But there's a lot of uncertainty, there's no way of telling, and he just walks on by. And most of the people there would have said, you know what? That's a difficult situation. It's a hard situation, and it's okay. It was a hard call, but I'm sure you made the right one. And the same with the Levite. Now, the Samaritan gets off his donkey, and the beautiful thing about that for the story, as Jesus is telling it, is the people who are listening to the story don't like the Samaritan, so if he gets killed, well, you know, big deal. So he goes over and he bandages the guy, he looks after them, he soothes them, he puts them on his donkey and he takes them to an inn. Now here's the funny thing about this story. There are no inns on that road. As a matter of fact, there were no inns on this road up until the 1500s. It runs through the middle of nowhere. There is no water. When the Crusaders arrived, they built fortified forts and inns along that road to provide shelter, but they had an army to supply it with food and water, which is why they could keep these remote outposts running to try to keep prevent lawlessness from spreading across the region. But in the time of Jesus, there are no inns on the road. All of the inns are miles off the road. You have to go a long way out of your journey to go and find one. So when it says he took him to an inn, it's not that he just went a few more miles down the road, found one, and said, oh, this one will do. He had to go off hunting for one. And all of the settlements either side of that road are Jewish. All of them. So the implication is, in this story, that the guy beaten up was indeed Jewish. Because a Samaritan wouldn't take a beaten Samaritan to a Jewish village to be looked after. That's not going to happen. One of the guys who mentored and taught me as a Christian just after I became a Christian was called by the name of Ken Bailey. And he said, look, just imagine the following scenario. Let's fast forward this picture into the good old days of cowboys and Indians. Now, he says, imagine a red Indian on his horse. He sees a naked cowboy with arrows sticking out of his back. Gets off his horse, inspects him, he's alive. Puts him on the horse, and he leads the horse into Dodge City. He ties up the horse outside the saloon bar, picks up the body, walks into the saloon, and puts it on the bar. He then says to the bartender, this is one of yours. Here are some coins to pay for his food and his medical expenses. And the next time I'm passing through town, I'll call in, and if I owe you any more money, I'll settle it up with you then. And he turns around and starts to leave. And as he's leaving, the film ends and the credits start rolling up. Now, what do you want to know at that point? What is the question you want to have answered? What is it? Is he going to leave alive? I mean, there he is. He walks into the saloon bar. All the cowboys are there drinking. He puts the body on the thing. He turns around and the film ends. If you were watching a movie and that would be happening, you'd be going, oh, I don't believe it. They're going to make a sequel. They're forcing me to buy another ticket just to find out the end of the story. That's so unfair. And that's where Jesus' story ends. The cost to the Samaritan of doing this may cost him everything. We sometimes think that the issue in this story that Jesus is talking about is the handing over of two small coins. You know, a few days' wages to pay for the guy's bills. We think that's the sacrifice that's been made. We think that's the price that's been made. The price is much bigger than that. This guy may not walk out of that place alive. This is not a comforting story for children. This story teaches that even though it may cost us our lives, we're required to lay them down in service of others. There's a big difference between Christian martyrdom, where we lay down our lives in service of others, and other forms of martyrdom, where we take our life in the process of taking other people's around us. Those are not the same. The Christian faith and what Christ taught about how we should live is nothing to do with convenience. It is not about convenience. He demands everything. He demands it all. He wants everything. When Christ asked us to follow him, he said that we were to deny ourselves, pick up our cross, and follow. Our challenge in the West is we have a form of Christian discipleship that doesn't demand everything. And we're then surprised when it doesn't seem to produce very much. But because we have money and expertise and technology, we can export it around the world. And we can sometimes think that we're doing a great job in doing so. This is not about convenience. Christ did not go to the cross because it was convenient. He went to the cross because he was committed to do his Father's will. Not my will, he said, but your will be done. He was willing to give his life as a ransom for many. He was willing to lay down his life to pay the price that we may be forgiven. That's what Liam's been talking to us this morning. That's what he's been sharing with us. Christ gave everything. God came into this world and gave everything. And if he did not spare his own son, if he gave everything in order to rescue us, what does that say about how much we should love him? What does it say about how we follow him? What does it say about what's been placed before us? What does it say about our willingness to lay down our lives? Look, the worst thing that can happen to you by being a Christian is someone kills you. That's the absolute worst. And if they kill you, you go to be with Jesus. So the way Paul thinks about it is, look, I'd like to stay here with you, but actually, I think I'd much rather be up there with him, because you're nice. But actually, Jesus is better. Yet so often we live our lives in a way to hold on to everything here and now, as if this is the world we're living for. This is the world we are living in. There is a different world we are living for. And it helps us make sense of how we hold lightly on to everything here. You know, it's incredible. We're meeting here in this site. Most of us who are meeting here did not pay to put this here. Someone else sacrificed. Other people gave so we could reap the benefit. I'm so excited by what's happening down in the Derwent Project. I can say this openly and freely because I'm not a trustee and I'm not on the leadership and I'm not part of this at all. But I think that what that's being proposed in the Derwent site is incredible. I think it will bless generations to come. Thousands of missionaries have gone forward from this place in the Keswick's history around the world, and I think 1,000 more will go in the decades to come. What an opportunity to invest in that. Why not give sacrificially into that? But the simple truth is as soon as it comes to our money, it's amazing, isn't it? One of my friends who's an evangelist says, most of us English people, we hold on to the pound so tightly, we make the Queen cry. God is looking for a people who will give him everything. If you are prepared to stand out and give him everything, you may be amazed at the results. Let me just give a few words of practicality, because sometimes when we talk about these stories, it helps just to be able to just imagine it. Let me just start, first of all, with something that's just a bit more difficult. Some of you know we run a center in Oxford to train people in apologetics and evangelism. They come from all over the world. We had a few guys, most years we have a few guys come to us from the Middle East. I won't mention the country, but one of them wrote to me recently. Now, what you may not know is since the Arab Spring, since the Arab uprising, in which thousands, tens of thousands, and probably hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, atheism is on the rise in the Middle East. It's one of the most startling effects of the Arab Spring. Rampant atheism. Richard Dawkins' books have become bestsellers in some Arabic countries. Well, one of them wrote to me. He was asked to go and speak to these people, and this is what he said. He says, please forgive the long email. He says, but I have to tell you the story. He says, I have been invited to speak to a group of 60 atheists yesterday. They were in a camp discussing atheism and Christianity. Most of them are not even familiar with Christianity. On short notice, I was invited to speak on the topic, are God's laws an obstacle to freedom? I got ready and I went. My friend came along with me, another graduate from the center, and I took four young guys that I'm discipling so they could also intercede and engage. Now, in passing, I mention this because we are a very religious country. So being an atheist is usually by conviction and against a lot of resistance. It's not because of apathy or cultural influence. Now imagine 60 intense, Middle Eastern, angry atheists, some of whom have spent time in prison for their atheism, sitting in one room with one poor Christian. Mayhem is the right description. Completing a single sentence, let alone a complete thought, was impossible. As a culture, we lack the courtesy of civil conversation, as you know. We overpower, and that's exactly what happened. I got a lot of people shouting and throwing curse words at me. It was lots of fun. For them, the question of God's rules was irrelevant, given they didn't want to believe in God in the first place. The very notion of God is absurd and despicable to them. They kept pushing to more basic questions about the very existence of God. I decided to ditch my talk and give an open discussion. We spent the next 3 hours going backwards and forwards in Middle Eastern-style Q&A. That means everyone talks at the same time. And although they were very aggressive, they seemed to respect the fact that I took their questions seriously. As time went by, it got better. They listened more. We talked past each other less. Something was happening. Finally, someone explicitly asked me just to say, as a Christian, what I believe in. Why did God create this blank world, he said. And for 10 amazingly uninterrupted minutes, I shared this Christian story. Trinity, creation, fall, redemption, restoration. It seemed obvious they'd never heard any of it before. The session ended at 10 p.m., and until 4 a.m. the next morning, we talked and talked. Some finally said they could see a way forward. Pray for these people. Most of them hate religion because it has caused them pain and abuse in their lives. I found myself deeply in love with them. The organizers just called me an hour ago, asking me to come back to the camp tomorrow and speak about evil and suffering. As the assigned speaker they asked to come has just declined. I'm currently trying to reshuffle my schedule, and I hope I can go back. Please pray for me. People are out there risking their lives. But sometimes it's small things. I have three children. The eldest is, my youngest is called Amelia. She's now 11. She loves baking. She wants to be the bake-off champion. My son, who's going to be 14 at the end of August, loves all things sporty and is very, very committed to also his studies and loves debating and talking. He is known in his school as the only Christian and as the Christian evangelist. He once actually took over his entire RE lesson for 45 minutes so the RE teacher could ask him difficult questions, and he seemed to do pretty well. Now, my eldest daughter, she's now 16. She's 5 inches shorter than me, but she has longer legs than me, which is why I'm rethinking through this whole gun control thing. Now, a couple of years ago, when she was 14, she'd finally grown her hair all the way down to the bottom of the small of her base of her spine. So the hair went all the way down to here. And I was going away on a trip, and as I was getting ready to go away, she came to me and she said, "Daddy, you need to be prepared for a surprise, because when you come back, my hair will be a bit shorter than it is now." I didn't think very much of it, but I knew things were serious, because when I landed in the country, before I got home, my wife rang me while I was still on my way from the airport back to the house and said, "Michael, when you come home, you are to say nothing about Lucy's hair, apart from the fact that she is beautiful." So, 40 minutes later, I'm at home, I knock on the door, Lucy opens it, and her hair has been cut all the way up to here. So I'm a man under authority, so I smile, and I say, "Sweetheart, you look beautiful." Now, 3 days later, I'm finally alone at home with my eldest daughter, because my wife leads the cello section in a small orchestra in Oxford, and she's off rehearsing. And so now, finally, here is my opportunity to ask the question I have been dying to ask. So I just start breathing gently in, out. Smile. Yeah, so it comes out right. I'm worried about the tone. So I'm smiling, and I'm just breathing calmly. And then I turn to her, and as casually as I can say, I say, "So, sweetheart, what changed the hairstyle? Was it fashion? Was it you just bored? Did you want to try something new?" And she said, "Well," she said, "I was watching this documentary last month about this charity that make wigs for 7 and 8 year old girls who have cancer. And because of the cancer treatment they have, they lose all their hair. And they were saying that they couldn't get enough hair to make wigs for these girls. So while you were away, I had my hair plaited and cut off, and I put it in an envelope and I mailed it off to that charity so they can make a couple of wigs for these girls." And as I sat there looking at her, she's a very avid reader, my eldest daughter. And I said, "Do you remember reading Little Women?" And she said, "I do." There's a scene in that book where the heroine, who's a bit feisty, cuts off her hair and sells it so she can buy a train ticket for her mother, so her mother can go and visit her father, who's dying in a field hospital many miles from home. And as the mother takes the money, she looks at her daughter and says, "Your hair will grow back, but you will never be more beautiful to me than you are right now." And as I looked at Lucy, that was the only thing I could think of sharing with her as I heard that. When you are committed to something and you believe in it, it should change the way in which we operate, in which we work, and how we live. It's coming back to that tension that we heard about earlier this morning, about so living before other people, that people will give thanks to God in heaven because of the difference that they see. God can do big things with even small amounts. Final illustration. I have a very good friend by the name of John Bechtel. He was a missionary with something called the Christian Missionary Alliance for many, many years. He then worked with something called the Demos Foundation, which worked actually with many well-known Christian leaders, many of whom would be actually very well-known on this platform, or known to some of you because of this platform. His family were forcibly expelled out of China when all the foreign missionaries were thrown out. That was his father. They relocated to Hong Kong. He grew up there. And eventually, he wanted to set up a camp summer camp to help all the kids who seemed to have nowhere to go during the summer. And he found the perfect site. Now, during that time, Billy Graham came to visit the country. And a guy traveling with Billy Graham, a businessman, heard about the vision for this camp. He said, "That's the most amazing vision I've ever heard. I'm going to go back to America. I'm going to tell people about the vision you have for this camp. And I'm going to raise all the money you need to buy it." Now, this guy was over the moon, thinking, "Wow, I've got the camp." A few months later, he gets an envelope. He opens it up. There's a letter from this man. "Dear John, things have not gone as well as I hoped. I have not received the money I was hoping to get for you to buy your camp. I have only received one donation, and it's enclosed in the envelope that you'll find in this envelope." So he looks inside the envelope, and behold, there's a second envelope with his name written rather poorly on the front. And he opens it up. And inside, there is a letter written by a 12-year-old girl. "Dear John, I heard about the camp that you want to build for the children. This is my ice cream money, $1. Please use it to buy the camp." Now, I know John fairly well. He assured me that most of the thoughts that went through his mind at that point were not Christian. His wife said, "Sweetheart, the letter is asking you to use this money to buy the camp. Think about it." Well, the next day, he went to the estate agent and said, "I want to make an offer on the property for sale." And he handed over the letter from the girl with the $1 bill in it. The agent laughed and threw it back in his face. John said, "Worse the effect of, as an agent, you are legally obliged to pass on every single legitimate offer you receive on any property. And if you don't pass this on, I'm going to report you." A week later, he gets a phone call from the trustees. They say, "We have read that letter by that girl and we are very moved by it. And because of what you want to do to help these children, we will sell you this camp for $1. I go to Hong Kong frequently. I have met hundreds and hundreds of people whose testimony starts, "I came to Christ through that camp in Hong Kong." 25 years later, John was telling this story in a church. And after he'd finished sharing it, a lady came up and said, "Mr. Bechtel, I am that 12-year-old girl who sent you that dollar bill 25 years ago. And I had no idea of what had happened to it." And John's quite a boisterous man. He sent the elders of the church out into the car park to drag people back in. And having dragged them back in, he introduced them to this lady and said, "Let's take a collection so we can send her to Hong Kong to see what she did with her dollar, her ice cream money when she was a 12-year-old girl. Well, they raised enough money to send her, her family, her friend's family, and half the British Army back to Hong Kong. $1. The smallest gift in the hands of God can make the most tremendous difference. God is calling us to give everything to Him. He is asking us to lay down everything to Him, no matter how small, no matter how insignificant, to live for Him. Without regard to what the physical price may be, and who knows, in this country, we may be moving into a time where we will be maybe suffer loss of freedom and loss of other things, because we will not give up on the call to be obedient to the Christ who gave His life for us and to change us. If you are a Christian and you are not given over to Christ completely, I would urge you this morning, be reconciled to God. God made Him who had no sin to be sin for us, that we may be reconciled with Him. And if, as have you been listening to all of these Bible readings this morning, you're here and you don't know Christ, I would urge you, give your life to Him. He has ransomed you. He's bought you for a price. He's made it possible for you to be forgiven and to know Him. And He has a calling for your life. And in that calling, you'll find the greatest fulfillment and joy you could possibly imagine. Well, I want to thank you for listening to me. You've been very gracious. And what I said I'll do is we'll take the last few minutes and we'll just take just a couple of questions. I've spoken for slightly longer than I planned. Please forgive me for that. But if you have one or two questions, I'll try and take them. And then we'll let you go to enjoy the half an hour of sunshine before it turns to rain. Would anyone like to ask a question? Okay, there's someone right down here at the very front.
I'm sorry. Sorry, I've forgotten the name of the chap that wrote the book. But Straw Dogs,
John Gray, yes.
John, getting old. Is he saying that he rejects Christianity because it doesn't fit in with his theory?
You know, it's very interesting. The question is, did John Gray reject Christianity because it doesn't fit in with his theory? What John Gray argues is that humanism, which he thinks is just simply Christianity and secularism, needs to be destroyed. So what he wants to first and foremost do is reject humanism. What he wants to do is have a political economy, a new political theory, which is compatible with modern-day science, where the strong prey on the weak. So he says, look at Britain. He says, we look after the poor, the weak, the needy. But natural selection, evolution tells us these people should be eliminated. So we're going against the natural order of things. We're going against our scientific understanding. What we need, Gray argues, is a new political form of government, a new political theory, which is compatible with what we know to be true. So his argument is, if you look at all of human history, the strong prey on the weak and the weak get eliminated. So let's embrace that. And so what he blames Christianity for is for creating a counterculture in which that doesn't happen. Now, what I do find interesting about Gray is he has one other quote which I didn't read, and I would love to have this conversation with him. He's a very brilliant man. I mean, far more brilliant than I am. He studied at St. John's, Oxford, I think, if I get that reference right. But then, having said that, anyone who studied Oxford sounds more intelligent than anyone else. But what he says is this. Having critiqued humanism, where he says that humanism believes that we can make ourselves better, that we can save ourselves. He then goes on to say this, and it's very interesting. He says, the biblical myth of the fall of man, however, contains the forbidden truth. Knowledge does not actually make us free. It leaves us as we always have been, prey to every kind of folly. Now, isn't that interesting? He's saying human wisdom will not save us. And the greatest atrocities that we've performed in the 20th century were technological, by the world's most educated people, not the least. And that's what he's picking up on there. And I think he's right. I agree with almost everything Gray says. If there is no God, everything else he says follows. If there is a God, then very clearly there's a very different trajectory. And I think even Gray is willing to admit that. If there is a God and we are created in his image, everything looks different. Not just some things, but everything. It's a very good question. Do you want to take one more, or should we wrap it up? Because I tell you what, why don't we do this? Because we only have 1 minute, 4 seconds left of this particular session. Let me just leave you with one concluding thought, if I may. I mean, I know I've already talked for far too long and you're desperate to get out. But let me just leave you with this. We heard earlier this morning, we've been listening all this week out of Matthew chapter 5. Do you remember when we started talking about salt and light? If you were there for that. It's interesting that Jesus uses these two words. Light, by definition, works visibly in our culture. Salt, however, works invisibly. You don't see salt at work doing what it does. Salt, there are some parts of the Christian ministry where we need to make contact with what we want to affect, because you can bring salt this close to a piece of meat. If it doesn't make contact, it makes no difference. And you don't see it at work. And if you are here wondering how you can make a big difference for the kingdom and give your all, don't worry about if what you're being done is not being seen. That's really, I think, a lot of what Jesus says springs out of that opening illustration. A lot of the kingdom work is invisible. But one last thing. He also says that if salt loses its saltiness, it cannot be made salty again. Here's the problem that Jesus has given us. Salt is the most stable compound known unto man. You grind salt up, you have salt. You heat salt, you have salt. You dissolve it in water, you get rid of the water, you have salt. Salt can't lose its saltiness. Now, the reason we think that way is the salt of the 21st century has been purified. But the salt of the first century that came from the great salt lakes in Cyprus and the Red Sea had impurities in it. And if those impurities hit a certain level, the salt loses its saltiness. The Greek word Jesus literally uses is this. If salt becomes foolish, in the Greek, if salt becomes a moron. Now, the Greek word moron, we translate into the English word moron. It means to be a moron. Jesus is saying, don't be stupid. And don't be morally stupid in your life. If we are not living the way God would have us live, the salt becomes useless. It can't We won't change the meat. It won't do anything else. And we've lost it. The wonderful thing is that God offers us forgiveness. He can cleanse us. And he can give us a new start. And if you need that, please don't leave this tent today without having someone pray for you. Thank you very much. You've listened very graciously. Enjoy your afternoon.